Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Randall Okita, a filmmaker whose work includes the 2014 short The Weatherman and the Shadowboxer and the 2016 short The Choir, as well as a segment of the 2017 web documentary Brand Canada. His first dramatic feature, The Lockpicker, becomes available for rental and purchase on iTunes this month, and you should absolutely check that out. Randall picked Kids, Larry Clark's controversial 1995 debut about a handful of teenagers knocking around New York City, doing drugs, and having casual sex in the age of HIV. Written by actual teenager Harmony Korine, and featuring the screen debuts of Chloe Sevigny, Rosario Dawson, and John Abrams, among others, it was marketed as a bold, daring vision of present-day morals and mores, though Clark's vision, as packaged by distributor Harvey Weinstein, is something we really have to talk about. We talk about a lot of things, actually. This is someone else's movie.
To me, it was an important movie as an audience member when I saw it, and it, you know, changed my brain in a lot of ways. But in the conversation that I am now steeped in and think about all the time about how we make things,
sure,
and especially coming from just making a film with a bunch of young people, you know, and I look back and I'm a fan of the movie as I saw it, and there's all the aspects that we're talking about, part of what I call, you know, creative inflation.
Sure.
When you see something and what it means, and then you look back at it and you're like, oh, that was actually really racist, or
yeah,
that's completely atrocious. And, you know, looking back at the way they made it and you know, reading or hearing stories from Christine Vachon and different people involved and seeing what everybody has gone on to do and the way that, you know, it's an important example for me of all of those investigations, because I feel like there was some problematic ways that they were working, and you know, it's up to us now to kind of parse that out and figure out what that means and what we want to apply to our processes moving forward.
Yeah, well, this is really the first time that on the podcast that I've encountered a film where backwards and forwards are completely different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that this is the first. I don't think it is. We did, Molly McGlynn picked American Beauty,
mm-hmm,
in August of last year, and, mm-hmm, it was a TIFF episode, and then a month later, it's like, oh, well, that's, a lot of those things don't sound right anymore, mm-hmm, even though the film itself is still the film,
mm-hmm,
and the accomplishments in it. Kevin Spacey's really good. That's, mm-hmm, kind of the problem. Kevin Spacey was a good enough actor that being exposed as a monster makes it worse on his performances, mm-hmm, because you don't have to reinterrogate, right? People aren't, which is the really awful part. Harvey Weinstein, you know, hopefully die in prison. That would be great. He was a terrible person to a lot of people who I like and respect, and even though I had no love for him ever, this is an easier break. I see his name on movies and I'm like, ugh, right. But because he didn't direct them and because he probably just acquired a lot of them, I can make that jump in my head and I can divorce myself. Kids is, like, Weinstein tied himself to it so hard in 95. I mean, he bought it because he knew Disney wouldn't release it. It was a way of demonstrating Miramax's independence, mm-hmm, after he'd sold them the studio. Mm-hmm. Created, I think it was called Shining Excalibur Pictures, to release it in the U.S. It was, mm-hmm, a one-off distribution company that he designed, and it was all because it was a magnet. Every year there had to be a Miramax film that was NC-17 and that, mm-hmm, he fought the rating on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, his fingerprints are all over this movie. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in the research, I found out that Mia Kirshner had been part of it and then was fired. So even before he got hold of it, his tentacles have touched it retroactively, mm-hmm, now. Mm-hmm. You can't not think about these. Or you can not think about these things, which is the bizarre conversation people are having. Like, oh, does this mean his career is over because of all these stories? I'm like, well, it should be.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're starting to get it's been almost a year, and people are starting to talk about maybe it's time to move forward, which means forgiving people. Or is it like Louis C.K. wants to do a comeback tour or something? And it's like, I don't know. Anyone who's ever had a fight with someone knows that they don't get to choose when you forgive them. That's just how that works. And with art, there's still the argument over Woody Allen and Roman Polanski. We're doing this in the shadow of Hannah Gadsby's Netflix show Nanette, where mm-hmm. she actually calls them out by name mm-hmm. As monster artists who were forgiven because they were white men, which is absolutely probably part of it. I think it's more than that. I think it's also because they were white men who were profitable. Mm-hmm. And Weinstein is one of the people who gave them chances and paid them to do work while he was also harming people. So that's a thing that's a big shadow on this movie, which is on its own already pretty controversial and yeah, borderline borderline unpleasant. It embraces its unpleasantness, but borderline pornographic, I think, in its celebration of the things that it's celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, over to you.
No, I mean, yeah, the thing that I think about is, you know, it's easy to say in a word, process, but the thing that I think about is the process that of collaboration. What is the tone that you're setting up? What are you talking about in a mm-hmm. film? And how do you want to talk about it? And, as a final piece, but also how do you want to involve people along the way? And what is it that you want them to feel during that process as right. well? And I feel like for so long, there's been this very tightly centralized power structure that sort of dominates the process, and very little consideration to the trauma that people have suffered over many years, sure. you know, in service of what we're calling art, or in service of what we call the creative process. And, the stories that are swapped about how directors would, you know, play tricks on actors or do things in service of reality, which somehow we constantly forget that we're just starting with the premise of, you know, it's not real. We're making a thing, yeah. but still somehow, you know, it's okay to at times abuse people in service of trying to, you know, create a mood or create a moment.
Right, because I think culturally we've convinced ourselves that however, like if you go home and cry that day, the moment still lasts forever. So you're making an immortal piece of art and your wounds will heal. I think that's the way it's always been processed, but then you look back and you realize just how much injury is being done to people in the name of art over and over and over again.
Right? Absolutely.
Like Alfred Hitchcock telling Billy Mummy he was going to nail his foot to the floor if he didn't stop squirming around. A 6-year-old's going to believe that.
Yeah.
Sarah Polley has written about her lack of protection on Baron Munchausen, where she was, I think, she was 9, mm-hmm. and she just wanted it to be over because it was terrifying and scary.
Yeah.
And because she was giving the performance of a terrified, scared child, it worked.
Yeah.
But now I can't watch that film again without mm-hmm. thinking that poor kid.
Absolutely.
And that's children. Adults are presumed to be stronger, right? So you can abuse them a lot more.
Yeah.
If you want to. Like, if you're that kind of person.
Absolutely. And I feel like these kinds of stories and these kinds of extreme behaviors have been, romanticized and forgiven and overlooked and in fact sort of celebrated in terms of, the crazy creator manipulation to get that thing.
Sure.
And people go to this, I think, a lot. People it seems like an easy place to go to sort of explain, magical moments, and it's easy to forget the, incredibly vast number of beautiful, amazing pieces that were made by nice people
yeah.
that had great experiences, and that people that didn't have to bang down doors and that didn't have to threaten and that didn't have to do those things. And because it, I think at first glance, seems just like people going to work and doing good work and being thoughtful and being considerate and maybe taking a lot longer or making some sacrifices for schedule or for, tutoring on set or these kinds of things, that it's harder for people to shout about. But I mean, I think that's where the work is, and that's the thing that we should be studying.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think about this a lot, and I talk about this, with people that I'm working with younger filmmakers that are interested in the process, because it's easy to go to these crazy stories, and that's what we read about and we hear about, and it's easier to write about in short form, sure. You know, these kind of punchy stories of you know, bringing snow from other places, or right. You know, pulling a trick on an actor in a vulnerable moment.
Yeah. Print the legend, right? Yeah. You want to hear how hard this stuff is,
yeah.
because that inspires you. Mm-hmm. But it also tells you that it's okay to do that stuff, mm-hmm. which it really isn't and should never have been.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think anybody was beaten up on Jaws, and it's one of the greatest artistic accomplishments in cinema because the shark didn't work. And it's people, I'm sure they were angry. You know, like, I'm sure they kicked the shark.
Yeah.
But I don't think that you can say that, like, everybody on this movie is working to, I guess Robert Shaw got drunk and annoyed people, but I don't think people were punching each other. It's a beautiful piece of work, and it's just the first thing that comes to mind. I know people don't regard it as an art film, but it's a goddamn triumph.
Absolutely.
And it's the kind of movie that you only get when people are trying really hard together. Yeah. And that's, Hank, if I ever find out Steven Spielberg smacked a child, it's going to break my heart. But yeah, you don't need to be, bad boys grow up to be bad men,
yeah.
right? Like you're reinforced for the swagger. And that the thing about kids and Larry Clark in general is just around the time of Bully, I think I just thought, no, I'm done. He's doing that thing that I don't like. And it's like, you just know he's a guy who yells at waiters. He's not a generous artist. Mm-hmm. He's very clearly fixed on what he wants. And what he wants is the thing that gives him praise. So he made Kids, and then he made more movies, and they're all kind of the same in their posturing and their disregard for humanity. And I think, you know, one or two of those is an aesthetic statement. Todd Solondz can do it over and over again and find new ways to do it, but I still believe on some level he cares whether his characters live or die.
Yeah.
And the thing about, well, Kids is different. Kids was the first one, and so it came out like a bomb. It exploded, and culturally everyone was talking about it, and I saw it at a press screening, I guess, before it opened, and thought, yeah, okay, I get this. It's an indie. It's his idea of what an indie is.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the actors are very talented, but morally, I don't think I like this.
Did you know instantly? Like, did you think instantly? And when you say morally, do you mean...
By the time the credits rolled,
And did you think because of the way that you thought it was made?
Yeah, I think... Well, I mean, just the packaging of it. And I mean, by that, I mean the cinematography and the style, just the sense. The tone of the film is remote. But not in a way that made me feel like I was watching a social study. It's sensationalistic and remote at the same mm-hmm. time. It's like you're watching patient zeros, a bunch right. of different patient zeros running around.
Right.
You know what it felt like? It felt like a 50s pulp programmer, like a mm-hmm. juvenile delinquent picture.
Right.
And I'm old enough, I was old enough at the time, I guess I would have been like in my late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was familiar enough with the history of drive-in movies. It's like, oh yeah, that's one of these, but... it's got more graphic everythingness.
Yeah.
It's more language, more violence, more sex. And you can come away and think Rosario Dawson has amazing screen presence and Chloe Sevigny is going to be somebody
mm-hmm.
and that John Abrams guy is okay. But beyond that, I really understood why it was being celebrated as it was. But then I read Ebert's review where he was sort of going into contortions or convolutions morally about how the point is that there is no point, and that I think he said something like life has given Telly nothing.
Mm.
There's nothing in life that he likes. And it's like, okay, but that means he's a sociopath. That doesn't mean life has failed him.
Mm.
And if you treat this movie like Bicycle Thieves, that's the reading you're going to get. But I don't think Clark is making that. I think he's riding a wave, and this is how his sensibility packages it. I mean, obviously you had a different response or we wouldn't be discussing it.
Sure.
But I don't mean to trap you into a corner.
Not at all.
But my take on it was that it was bizarre that it was being celebrated to the level that it was. But I think that's the Weinstein genius of it. He was the best marketer film has ever had. And he could package something into a cause célèbre. I mean, you got Dershowitz to defend the NC to contest the NC-17 rating on this, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. That was the one. And it was just so people would talk about his products more. Like, it's genius marketing, mm-hmm. but the film itself doesn't stand up to the defenses of the age that were used at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me.
I mean, in my opinion,
of course, of course. I would say a couple things. I mean, first, yeah, the I can't separate entirely, you know, my perspective now from my perspective when I saw it, and you know, when I saw it, it was lightning to me. I'd never seen anything like it, and it completely transformed my idea of what, you know, cinema could be, mm-hmm. in a way that I still haven't recovered from.
Okay, and what was your first experience of it? How old were you? Where were you? When did you see it?
I was a teenager in Calgary, and I saw it on VHS.
Okay.
Yeah. And I would just say, you know, I was hanging out with a group of people, and we weren't up to a lot of positive things. And there was, I connected with a group of young people doing things for no good reason, other than, you know, maybe a boredom. Right. And just like a feeling of, and for me this is yeah, a feeling of dearth, you know, things missing and chasing something and not, and a feeling of kind of nobody really watching, and that there aren't those sort of nets or safety mechanisms or people with a more responsible mindset kind of intervening here, and the kind of charismatic people in a group being maybe not really good people.
Yeah.
And just this kind of sad but energetic, scary but alive kind of energy of that. Like that I very much connected with and thought, I've never seen that. I recognize that. I recognize some of these scenarios that seem fun, but they're also just so dangerous. And as a young person feeling, you know, having those kind of thoughts in terms of my environment, and then seeing that, and this, you know, changed my brain. It was an incredible, incredibly powerful experience. Of course, in retrospect, I mean, one of the ways that I put things, one of the ways that I think about it is a phrase that I heard somebody say once. It's like, it's okay to love and hate things at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think that, in terms of the conversation that we're having, but that everybody's having now, I think that people just need to recognize that and say that too, because it's okay to have loved something before you understood the context that it was in. You know, it's okay to have loved a dear friend of yours before you realize that it was a toxic relationship, sure, in many, yeah, ways. And, you know, the fact that they helped you through some hard times or counseled you in a certain way that, you know, you realize was maybe not the best in, you know, terms of mental health in the long run, but all of the, like, it, that's okay. And we as human beings are constantly going to be, you know, having these conversations and retrospectively rationalizing, post-rationalizing, yeah, things and growing and becoming better and becoming more aware. And it's not useful to beat ourselves up too hard, but it is, you know, I think it is our responsibility to continue to grow and to, you know, continue to do better and do better. I mean, in my case, I think of that in, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've read Christine Vachon's books, and, yeah, you know, she talks about the making of the film, and you talk to people, you know, there's interviews out there about how they made it in out there now. And, you know, you don't do that. And is it possible to get at some of those things that I think were powerful in terms of cinematic language, in terms of representation, in terms of you know, storytelling techniques, but without traumatizing people and without, yeah, exploiting people and without... and I think it's a difficult question, and one that, you know, we talked about a lot in terms of making The Lockpicker. And, you know, I saw Cass in your collection, and to me that's another incredible film and incredibly powerful experience for me as an audience member. And there's, you know, that's a different process and that's a different sort of intent. And but also kind of, I think about when I, you know, talking about working with young performers, mm-hmm. That don't have experience and what you're asking of them and what the film itself is trying to do as well. You know, I think it's interesting how kids got funded as well and where that money was coming from and what it was supposed to be. And yeah, everything from,
it was the NEA, right? I mean, the National Endowment for the Arts, which was another controversy at the time.
Yeah, and it was intended to be about, you know, sexual health, and as a message about that. And
I mean, it kind of is.
Very kind of. You know, I mean, really, you can see how maybe at some point in a conversation it seemed like a good idea, yeah. That that's what it would end up being. Yeah, very, I mean, just incredibly interesting. I think, you know, Harmony Korine and how, you know, he has evolved and that, and Rosario Dawson, and yeah, all of those, that it's a very interesting intersection. And like I say, Christine Vachon, I'm a big fan of, and somebody who talks about process a lot and talks about, you know, collaboration and long-term collaborations and what those relationships want to look like for her, you know, over the span of a career, which is, I think, how people should be thinking, as opposed to just what can you get out of a project in the shortest amount of time possible.
Yeah. And Kids was, I don't know that it was made with bad intentions. I think that it was designed to be, I'm thinking about this the wrong way. The first thing I wanted to tackle was the idea that if it spoke to you when you were a teenager, if you felt you were seeing yourself or some aspect of yourself, then it worked. Then that's the point of it. That's the point of art, right? I came out of that movie knowing that I had seen it before, that there are versions of it. But if it's the first version of it that you encounter, then it's going to be revelatory, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not your fault that you were born when you were born, that it showed up when it showed up. It's one of those things that I've never understood, the complete disregard for people who are experiencing a genre or even a movie for the first time. Like, there are people who are like, you've never seen 2001, you're a terrible person. It's like, no, you can't see everything. I mean, you should see 2001, but you can't see everything. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I have holes. I've been lucky enough that in my career I've been in a position to receive things as they were reissued or remastered or re-released, so I'm pretty comprehensively caught up, but mm-hmm. I'm sure there's stuff that, you know, like, I haven't seen all of Ichikawa's films, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen all of Kurosawa's. There's probably a few. I know mm-hmm. there's a few. Mm-hmm. There are, I think my Japanese cinema is probably my biggest weakness, mm-hmm. and after that, German. But it's just about what was available and what was being restored and what I saw at the time.
Yeah.
And there are people who, you know, are younger than me or older than me and dismissive of new things, or younger and dismissive of older things. And Kids was clearly, it affected a generation mm-hmm. in a way that generation hadn't been affected before. Mm-hmm. And in that, clearly everybody knew what they were doing. Like, Corinne, I think, clearly believed he was the voice of his generation and that no one had ever said these things before. And he's versed enough in cinema now that I suspect he was kind of fronting at the time. Mm-hmm. But his bad boy image is more convincing to me. Like, his, I don't know, I just wrote what I saw. I wrote what I feel. I believe that more than I believe Clark saying he was out to photograph the truth.
Yeah.
Because Clark was, when he shot this, what, 52, 53? Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing that doesn't sit well with me. I mean, did you feel that when you were watching it? Did you feel that there was a sort of a male gaze aged thing going on? Or when you're in your teens, do you even look for that stuff?
Yeah, no, I didn't think that at all. I think I was just so shocked and so amazed, mm-hmm. and you know, so different than any other film I'd ever seen. In retrospect, for sure, I think it makes me uncomfortable, and it makes me, even with the amount of sort of reading and research that I've done, and kind of going back to it you know, in conversations like this, Yeah, there's still moments, and there's still where you know, because now as I when I watch it, kind of as a student, and I'm looking at moments, and I'm thinking about the age of the performers, and you know, I don't go back and watch it often, but when I do, and even when I think about certain scenes, it's just, you know, yeah, uncomfortable is the least of it. You know?
Yeah.
I'm curious, what films do you think are the predecessors or that fit in that sort of when you say that you'd seen it before? What films are on that list for you?
Oh, I would say stuff. I mean, the examples aren't going to line up exactly because the graphic nature just doesn't. I mean, the thing I thought of was The Wild One.
Yeah.
You know, like films like that, films, mm-hmm. you know, motorcycle punk movies, mm-hmm. even like to some extent. Well, West Side Story is a bad example because it's completely different, but it is the same basic, you know, mm-hmm. your parents don't understand you. You have to find release. You have to find your people mm-hmm. wherever you can. Mm-hmm. But the archetypal nature of that storytelling is something that goes further and further back.
Yeah.
You know, like it's Reefer Madness, really.
Sure.
That was the other one that I thought of because even when they need to go score pot, they get it from a Rastafarian. And it's just this casual racist thing that just happens. And it's like, this movie is constantly pushing and pulling between this is true, this is real, this is what's happening now, and that thing in the back of your brain going, there's no way she's 12, there's no way they're going to that guy, none of this is real, it's all performance. But that's the thing you get when you have a film from a first-time director and actors who aren't known to you. There is this undercurrent of, oh, this feels like documentary. This feels like it was just shot on the fly, and part of that is the style that he chooses. Mm-hmm. And then by the time he got to Bully, and he was still trying to pretend to be the ride-along camera, and also somehow shooting the crotch of someone's shorts in extreme close-ups, because, you know, that just happens when you have a camera.
Right.
It's this weird incredulity that the film has about what it's showing you. Not incredulity, that's wrong. It's, there was a disreputable sizzle, like a frisson of reality mm-hmm. to this movie, and that's how it was packaged, that's how it was sold, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. real kids, real time, real, like this is happening right now, mm-hmm. the day in the lives of. And if you step back a second, you realize every scene is built on some sort of dramatic contrivance. That's why I talk about things like Reefer Madness and The Wild One, where those movies have specific moral arcs that play out.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is a caution. It's designed as the same kind of cautionary tale mm-hmm. that those movies were. It's mm-hmm. just much more confrontational about what it shows you. And because it was written by a teenager, and mm-hmm. because it was filmed in the way that it was filmed and marketed, more importantly, we know all of this because of the marketing,
mm-hmm.
Because they leaned on that, then it became this huge, important...
Wait, leaned on what?
They leaned on the transgressive nature of it and the fact that it was right. written by a child.
Yeah. You know,
like that Corinne was, said, what, 17 when he wrote it? Or 18?
Yeah, I think
he was 19.
Supposed to be 19.
Okay.
Yeah, and then they made it when he was 20.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so he was 19. It was written... But it was, the idea was that he had just walked out of the skate park and written this movie
yeah.
about the things he saw and the people he knew.
Yeah.
And that's probably not true,
mm-hmm.
but it's romantic enough that you buy it. And then from that, that was, you know, that was the argument that everything you see is happening somewhere
mm-hmm.
In the real world. We're mm-hmm. we're just putting an artistic hat on it and putting it out in this box.
Yeah.
And, you know, the core of marketing is selling transgression. And if you can make that your thing, you make, as it turns out, you make $20 million worldwide.
Wow. Yeah.
But the cynicism of that decision, in retrospect, now, at the time, it was, you know, like everybody was talking about it. It was this whole thing that ripped the cover off of our comfortable 90s culture. And the 90s were pretty safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Clinton had been president for a couple of years. Everything was going along decently. We were all very happy. And then this movie came out and said, no, the kids aren't all right. And that happens every 10 years, no matter what, right? Now it's on TV, the Netflix series, 13 Reasons Why, things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, it was the movie house. That was the only place you could see the truth. Television wasn't going to show it to you. Books were maybe, it's The Catcher in the Rye. It's, mm. you know, it's all, it's every story about teenage discontent. It's rock and roll. It's punk. It's now whatever this is. And so it was perfectly positioned. And I don't know if 2 years later or 2 years earlier, it would have been as easily marketed. But where it arrived, when it arrived, and it did change the landscape.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
I am very cynical. I am very old and I am very cynical.
I think you're allowed to be. I mean, absolutely. I think Yeah, I mean, for me...
But yeah, if you were removed from that, right? Like, if you were a teenager somewhere and you hadn't had the chance to see it theatrically, mm-hmm. it would have been, like, found wisdom in a video store.
Yeah, and to me, there's, a, you know, the act of identification, like you said, I mean, that was so powerful. And the fact that it was so dark and it was... without relent and without any sort of redemption, I recognized and felt like it was very much a revelation, and just that felt very truthful. And I remember showing it to friends and talking about it with friends at the time. But you know, when and so there's elements of the energy of some of those scenes and some of those moments that I think, you know, kind of became examples or became examples that are sort of baked into the vocabulary of certain things. And so when we
certainly like Junkie Chic, Heroin Chic, that mm-hmm. movement, the Gap ads, mm-hmm. all of this was happening mm-hmm. at the same time, right and yeah. this captured that look in that
mm-hmm.
moment
mm-hmm.
but beyond that there's other resonances.
Yeah, and just thinking about, you know, when I was going to sort of shoot party scenes or to do certain scenes in our film, you know, we really had to take that process apart and talk about the energy and talk about it. And it came up sort of sometimes for me a bunch of different films, you know, including Cass, including All the Real Girls, you know, these sort of different kinds of representations of youth. But we knew that we were going to work with first-time performers, and so how do you set up that environment? How do you let people know why we are creating a traumatic moment fictionally, and how do you make sure that it's not a traumatic experience for them in any way in the making of that?
Sure.
And so part of what we wanted to do was we called this open book methodology of shooting, and we were partnered with a high school, and we were working with a number of students from the school, and so you know, we had a completely unreasonable to a traditional sort of production model schedule. We had a incredibly generous schedule, but so that we could engage in these conversations and have sort of very open dialogue about what was happening and why we were kind of creating these scenes that involved bullying or that involved you know, violence, so that the people involved could also understand. And to me, all of those conversations kind of feed forward into how we want to make things and how we want to talk about it. And I think, you know, back to what we were talking about earlier, the more that we can involve, the more that we can be having those conversations about the process that we're making things and the way that we're, you know, celebrating certain kinds of power structures and those dynamics, and I think the better we can make things, and the better we can make the making of things,
right.
Because otherwise, yeah, like when the power gets too centralized and you forget, and the model of production, the model of making things, becomes such that people don't question. And it's not normal to question the safety of something, whether that means psychologically or just physically, where people are being asked to do unsafe things, and we're not in a kind of tradition of just like, well, that does that make sense? And it's not, you're not bringing down a production, or you're not bringing down a process by questioning if that's possible to shoot. You know, should we be making a film with kids this young or with animals, you know,
sure.
in this way,
yeah.
and sometimes, you know, or with communities in certain ways, and sometimes, you know, the answer is maybe no, and you shouldn't.
Yeah, and would it? And then, what is your responsibility in that case? To rewrite it or to fake it completely and just not use that community, but tell their story anyway? How does that work? I mean, that's the question that has to be answered every time someone makes a film, I suppose. You know, like, how much authenticity is necessary to tell the story? And if you can't tell the story authentically without some sort of artifice. Like, what's the line? In kids, I'm pretty sure those kids, when they look uncomfortable, are uncomfortable. I don't know that they're good enough actors at that stage in their life. 7 years probably, and Dawson maybe, but you can't know, and that's the tension that drives the film, right? Like the idea that you're watching pain be transferred in real time is so. I mean, it's compelling if you believe that it's a dramatic. I mean, you know, Bergman and Cassavetes, and I believe those movies were made with, you know, massive effort and emotional stress, but I don't think anyone was broken forever. At least I hope not.
Yeah.
Peter Falk told a story once about working with Cassavetes on A Woman Under the Influence, and he had a question about the spaghetti scene and the dinner table scene. He had a question about what his motivation exactly was, because he said, the guy seems like he's being pretty mean to his wife and thoughtless. And the way he told the story was Cassavetes took him for a walk. They left the set, they walked around the block for 5 minutes. He came back, and they talked the whole time. And he came back in, and he dropped Falk back at his mark and said, okay, action, and they shot the scene. And Falk said, in that moment, it's like, he didn't tell me a fucking thing. He just talked to me, and he didn't explain a word. And he told me the story, and I was just delighted to hear it, because there's a... I mean, I'm sure that would have been maddening and frustrating, but it was also playful and harmless. In the end, right? Like, you end up angry and confused in the moment, but you can walk away and go, oh, he made that work. He found a way. No screaming, no shouting, no misery, nothing got broken. I don't necessarily feel the same way about Larry Clark as a filmmaker. And
absolutely.
Kids is, like, it's bristling with an energy that I don't fully understand, and that makes me nervous watching it. And that's the point, right? Like, it's supposed to put you on the back foot, and you're not supposed to know what's going on. It's only when you look back, it's like, oh yeah, it's a really conventional story. It's just being told in a way that's frazzled and weird.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's an entirely different concern when you're working with young people, because of the nature of consent and the nature of understanding and the nature of sort of participation. I think so that's its own conversation, I think, in terms of parents and awareness and making sure, teachers, and making sure that it's a safe and comfortable and productive, hopefully, and educational, hopefully, environment. I think when it comes to communities, the way that I always kind of think of it is that it should be up to the community. And I think that the hard answer, for a lot of times is if you can't, then you shouldn't. Like, if you can't, and I think that that's where we're at, and I think that's where we should be, is, if you're in a position where you're trying to tell a story that involves or is about a community, and you're not sure that you can do it in an authentic way, you probably shouldn't. And that's a really hard answer that, I've had to face, and lots of people I know, have had to face, and sometimes it's heartbreaking because of the nature of how hard it is to try to do the things we want to do, and how hard it is to find a story that you believe in.
Sure.
And, I think we're often afraid, and I say that sort of in a light way, but I think we're afraid to tell our own story, so it's easy to sort of see the romance or see the poetry in a slightly other community, but that you still connect with, but you see, and it's easier to kind of package that up and to see, the mechanisms, and be less precious with the mechanisms of a community because it's not yours. And, this is the nature of kind of making the things that we're making, but
and you're still able to have empathy for another, another life, another personality, another existence.
Yeah. But especially when, a community or where we have examples now of a community being misrepresented or being exploited.
Sure.
You can't do it. You can't do it anymore. And as soon as you become aware of these things, it will and should get consistently, not more complicated or difficult, but it becomes easier in a way to kind of know how to do it, I think, in a responsible way. And I think you in the long run too, you end up getting better work.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you can work through resistance, mm-hmm. but yeah, if there isn't any and people are open to your work, then it's going to be a richer project mm-hmm. for the input, mm-hmm. right? I mean, unless you, you know, unless you're Aaron Sorkin and you have the ability to realize your vision precisely as written above all other objections, mm-hmm. and he'll, you know, his entire thing now is about telling people how they should live and act morally. So, yeah, good, you know, good for him. He's cornered the market, but nobody else necessarily should be doing that, and maybe he shouldn't be either. But yeah, if the day he decides he's going to apply his vision to, you know, a remake of well, God help me, a film about Robert Flaherty shooting Nanook of the North, like something where I think he would see himself as correcting some moral injustice.
Right,
that's going to be horrible.
That's an amazing.
That's just where I see his talent going. That's right. You know, the white man's burden thing. Yeah, I don't know where to take that. It's just a thing that I've been thinking about for a while. Like, what would be the worst possible project for Aaron Sorkin?
Yeah.
It would be, you know what your problem is.
Well, what do you think about Nanook of the North?
I think it's a fascinating lie, mm-hmm. right? Because it is people doing the things that they did, but they're doing it for a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And it equates nicely to kids in a weird way, because we are supposedly seeing real people doing real things, mm-hmm. but we're not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they would probably be less, he's trying to get this whole noble savage mythology across and show, you know, look at the brave man with the harpoon, and it is brave to do those things, especially in a hostile environment in the 1920s when you can die if you trip and, you know, break a leg and can't get home. But it's Heisenberg, right? The presence of the observer changes the experiment. And now you can't say that it's a documentary,
mm-hmm.
but it is a fascinating snapshot of the way cameras were used and the way people regarded the other and what documentary was in 1927, which wasn't what it is now. I mean, yeah.
That's commonly, you know, called the first, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah. It's regarded as
the first documentary,
the first proper feature-length doc.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not, like, by any measure of that construction, mm-hmm. it's a fiction film.
Yeah.
Except that it isn't. Except that it is. It's fascinating, and you know, I'm really looking forward to the centenary and people really really grappling with it, because it's bound to come around.
Yeah. Absolutely. And yeah, there's the implements that they were using that I think they were asked not to use, and
yeah,
yeah.
It's a stage managed reality.
Yeah,
at best.
But yeah, and then the question: what's the better way to do that? Is the better way to make that film to have not made it?
Mm-hmm. And what would it be then? Like, even anthropological studies, even texts are questionable because they're from a perspective that is not the people being observed, right? Yeah. Like, everything mm-hmm. is, I think, you know, we still give Jane Goodall a pass because the chimps can't make their own documentaries, but right. other than that, that's a terrible analogy and I shouldn't have said that. I may delete that.
Fair.
But we don't know, like, cinema is designed by the people who designed it, right? Like, it's an art form that's presumed to be best understood by the people who invented the camera, which isn't necessarily true.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Well, I think what's also interesting these days is the great strides, in my not so humble opinion, that we've made in documentary. And what I've noticed is with the involvement or advent of 360 video, documentary seems to have a bunch of people seem to have forgotten sort of the evolution and the conversations that we've had about documentary for, you know, the last couple of generations, and all of a sudden people are using 360 video as a documentary tool in these incredibly, I think, exploitative, inappropriate, you know, ways that I think is just so interesting and sometimes disheartening to be like.
I'm trying to think of, all I can think of for 360 video is skateboarding videos, which is clearly
there's quite a few out there.
Is this the VR
I don't
want
to call I don't want to call any out by name, but yeah, it's, you know, there's poverty tourism and sort of you know, racist kind of you know, here you are in the middle of blank, and what's it like to be, and you know, you're using a technology which is again fairly modern, and not a lot of people have the headsets or the ability to kind of, but you are, you know, what would it like to be in the blank of blank, you know, the dangerous areas of the poor areas or the sick areas of, and you know,
you can take your helmet off, you're not really there.
We're showing these things in film festivals, the fanciest film festivals, and it's the bleeding, you know, and the people that are watching, and I'm appalled.
Well, it's disaster tourism, right? Yeah. Like, it's a form of...
And I thought that we sort of got over that, and people are calling these documentaries and somehow forgetting, you know, the conversations we've had over the last little bit, which I think is, makes me think of that trajectory and all of the conversations that we've had about films like this, like Night of the North and many others, and all of a sudden we're still just so easily just people like, have you seen this? And I'm like, guys, we can't. Why is nobody calling this out? I just learned this, you know, we just learned this in the last little bit, and you're realizing, and we're having this conversation here, and people are like, hey, VR, check this out. And I just think it's an interesting kind of correlation, or somehow with new technologies or something, we get greedy, or we, some people forget the learning that we've kind of just had.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm kind of opposed on a philosophical basis to VR documentary anyway, just because no one really lets you wander around. There's always a cinematic aspect. They're afraid you'll get bored. So it becomes more like gameplay, where something has to happen to nudge you in a direction. Mm-hmm. You know, look over here. There's a noise. Follow the noise. And it's like, well, but then just put it on a screen and let me watch it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to tell me a story, and you clearly do. Yeah, because until we actually have virtual representation and hologram whatevers, you're not going to be able to be on the Trail of Tears, or you're not going to be able to Westworld your way into a story.
Yeah.
And that's what these things are all supposed to be. And it feels like hucksterism, right? Like the drop the penny in and watch the bear dance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily believe in it at all. And, you know, and in that case, we're only ever 20 minutes from the pornographic application. A friend of mine, Patchen Bars, wrote a book called The Erotic Engine, which is about how pornography has actually driven economies, because tech is always repurposed.
Yes.
We're only ever 20 minutes away from kids, the immersive experience, right? The idea that you could watch Larry Clark's movie and be in it. But, gross. You know, it would smell horrible. But that's where this stuff always ends up leading, because the applications are inevitable. And the same kind of disreputable appeal is what was used to sell kids in the first place. The movie in the 90s is the idea of, come and see this thing that you can't see anywhere else, that you've never seen before. Mm-hmm. It's rated NC-17, so it goes further, even though it was just for language.
Sure.
I think that's why the film was as big as it was. But the lasting impact is for people who connected with it. That's different, and that's, I don't think that's why it was made, which is what's so fascinating to me, that it can still be a positive artistic experience, maybe unintentionally.
It's a different kind of context. I mean, it's interesting to hear your experience of it, and then you know, I mean, it's out there, and I've talked to people about it over the years, but I just remember watching it on VHS with a few friends, and just having, you know, my mind blown, and my eyes opened in a certain way. And it's also interesting, the VR thing you're saying. I'm working on a VR piece right now, which is it's a kind of VR called room scale VR. Have you tried this, where you put up the lighthouses and you can walk around? It's not just 360 video where you have to stay stationary, you can look around, and it's footage that's stitched together. It's more programmatic,
and so it's an environment that renders as you move.
Yeah, and you can walk around things, and you can pick things up, and it's an incredible experience, you know, and learning curve in terms of technology, but also it becomes this exercise in the basic mechanics of story again, and just what you can connect emotionally to, because the possibilities become exponential in the same way that, you know, animation or, you know, gaming, you can, if you're building everything, you can build anything.
Right.
But it still is such an interesting, for me, it's been an interesting exercise, just because you have to go back to the absolute basics, and just because you have an extra tool or two, it doesn't change, you know, how likely you are to get engaged in something and be familiar, or to have your, you know, to have your brain taken out of the immediate moment by the fact that you can do something that you couldn't do before, or the fact that you're thinking about this, you know, technology. Yeah, so it's an interesting time.
Where are you taking it? I mean, what's the appeal for you?
For me, I also make sculptures and sort of and installations and interactive kind of pieces that, you know, become environments that you occupy and move through, and to me it's a in its hopeful evolution becomes a combination of, you know, film, environmental control, lighting control, and storytelling, but in a physicalized way. I mean, a lot of the films that I'm drawn to and films that I make and the stories, you know, have sort of a inarticulate, a visceral kind of experience, and to me that's where a lot of things come from in terms of the things that I want to make, to express things that I can't otherwise, or I feel like I can't otherwise. And so to have the ability, this is one way that I look at it, is that you can have an audience of one, and you can have them experience a place and people or characters, we'll call them, but you know, and with a great deal of possibility. But I like the idea, I'm very attracted to the idea of putting you in a space and you have a pathway and something to touch and to have a story unfold around you, in front of you. You know, I still believe that people largely want to play a passive role, but there's still an extra layer of presence, an extra layer of interactivity that I don't think will transform everything, and I don't think that it will overcome, you know, traditional filmmaking and all of the great other ways of storytelling we have. But it's an interesting layer to be able to access and play with in a fun way, you know, at this point, because it's so nascent. I think it's great to sort of access and play with and just see, whether it's, you know, film fans or gamers or people that, you know, are into installations, and see how they move through it. You know, and like I say, to me, it's about story. It's about how do you tell or show somebody something and have them engaged emotionally with a trajectory that you're kind of presenting, and so it's at once like kind of this new, all these new layers, and it's just the very basics, you know, what can I tell you in a few minutes?
Yeah, who knows where it'll be in 5 years or 10 years. There's always an unexpected sidetrack thing that turns out, you know, no one understands development, right? We all just think we have a sense of a straight line.
Absolutely.
And then someone figures out something 20 degrees off and it just changes everything.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm fascinated to see where it goes.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a weird way to stitch in the final question of the podcast, but is there anything of in relation to this or any other project, is there anything of Kids, the Larry Clark film, that you have borrowed or stolen or incorporated into your own creative DNA? I can't really see it applying to VR. And you did discuss the responsibility factor. And
yeah, great question. I mean, I think the ideas that we've discussed, I mean, certainly there's a responsibility in the making of things, which I really, really value and sort of treasure above all things. I mean, it's not worth doing things if we're harming people, you know. And I say this all the time whenever it kind of comes up, and sometimes it's a question. And again, we go back to this sort of romantic idea of the guerrilla filmmakers and breaking the rules and doing the things. And sometimes that comes up against, you know, actual safety of people. And I'm just like, guys, we, you know, we have to remind ourselves we're making these things for people. It's completely, you know, against what we're claiming to be doing if we're willing to risk people along the way. That's not part of this. But then also, I think the idea of recognition, and for me, sometimes when I think I'm getting too personal, or that there's something that I want to express but maybe other people won't really connect with, I think about that in terms of, you know, it's more powerful to recognize something that you feel connected to than something that's sort of packaged in a way that might water it down a little bit.
Yeah. And just, I think, caring about that and caring about the people that you work with, that's the thing that distinguishes, I mean, yeah, it's such a weird, thorny concept, the idea of art that's worthwhile versus art that is important.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you get both and sometimes you get neither, and pursuing one over the other is kind of the aesthetic determination to begin with. And mm-hmm. if you're trying to make something that is, yeah, you know, if you chase controversy, more often than not you miss it, because by the time the film gets out, it's too late.
Yeah.
It's over, the moment passes. So you have to manufacture the controversy, and that you can usually tell. I mean, now I think we're really good at smelling at hype and detecting when the wool is being pulled over people's eyes. But yeah, my entire philosophy of life just comes down to don't be an asshole, which, you know, no one's mm-hmm. listening to these days, and it's exhausting. Yeah. But yeah, I don't think you have to be a monster to make art, and I think people not be.
Yeah, I think that's a great philosophy and a great way of putting it. I mean, the thing that I would add, you know, I mean, I would think of, you chase a process that's worthwhile,
mm-hmm.
you know, and one that everybody who engages with it is sort of hopefully elevated and made better. And to me, I really think the process of making things, the process of creating stories, is a real parallel to a good story. I think that those things are obviously inherently connected, but the idea of somebody going out and making a sacrifice for something greater than themselves, you know, making themselves vulnerable in the process and thinking about something bigger than them as a hero, as a protagonist of a story, is the same thing that people should be doing in the making of a story. You know, there's vulnerability in that process. By virtue of people being vulnerable and making themselves vulnerable and taking risks in a creative engagement, you're going to care about other people. It's not about protecting yourself and making sure that you're the most on budget and you're the most artistically competent, and it's about taking a chance with something that you perhaps don't know will be successful. It's not a home run, but in that process the reason to do that is for something that will reward everybody in the end, by virtue of making something that's bigger than any one, you know, single component of the filmmaking team or the storytelling team. And I think if you do that and don't be an asshole while doing it,
yeah,
it's worth it. Even if the film or story or project, you know, is on some level of measure not the most successful thing ever, everybody will sort of live to fight another day, and you will learn good, honest lessons, and hopefully you'll want to work with people because they weren't assholes and you weren't an asshole to them, you know.
Well, that's the other problem with this, the alternate process, right? There can only be one asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, it's just yelling. It's just everybody yelling back and forth. And if you have a dictatorial filmmaker as opposed to a delegating filmmaker, it's going to be unpleasant for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, you know, 2 years later, yeah, you can look back and, oh, that was a good show. We did all right. We made a good movie in spite of whatever. But it's got to be so much better to just be able to stop after, oh, that was a good show.
Mm-hmm.
And just enjoy the memory.
Yeah. And we have to stop. I feel like it's just, we have to stop celebrating that loudness, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a little bit extra work, but I think that we have to celebrate the people who quietly do great work, you know, whether it's politically or otherwise, just that didn't shout all the time and that weren't mean all the time, but got incredible results, because that's the magic, you know. We've all seen bullies at work,
yeah.
and we've all experienced the efficiency or lack thereof, and it's, you know, the less loud, you know, people that are incredibly efficient or incredibly good at their jobs that we need to kind of keep looking to, that are, how they're staying consistently productive.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah,
let's find more of those people and just donate money to them, and or I mean, that's what community organizing is, right? Just being able to pull people together for something mm-hmm. without hopefully domineering and yelling and mm-hmm. making them regret doing it in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge part of these, you know, longer form conversations.
Yeah.
And I think people forget that they don't have to be short form insults, or
yeah.
you know, they don't have to be short form celebrations and or insults, and that's it. You just have, you know, those two choices. It's about a conversation. It's about a community that you want people to stay involved in, and you know, the making of things, the sharing of things, the talking about things. I think it's very much, I mean, this is why we're doing it. It is about community building or community growing, or, you know, keeping the threads of conversation alive in a community so that everybody can be a little bit healthier or more informed. Or,
yeah. That's what we're here for.
That's what we're trying for, yeah.
My thanks to Randall Okita, whose first feature, The Lockpicker, will be available for rental and purchase on iTunes later this month. You really ought to watch it. Thanks also to Samantha Macken. She knows what she did. You can follow Randall on Twitter at Randall Okita, all one word, and while Kids is currently out of print on DVD, there are quite a few copies kicking around. It costs a small fortune if you order it from Amazon, but I've found it at used DVD shops for under $20. If you want it, it's out there. If you want it. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.